July 8th, 2013, Denver, Colorado, Bhagavatam class, program titled Yoga of the Tongue.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Anyone here for the first time? Thank you, welcome. My name is Vaisheshika Das, and I'm visiting from Silicon Valley, California. We have an ashram there, and I have a fondness for this community here in Denver, and I feel fortunate to have been invited here to talk on this topic today, which is called Yoga of the Tongue. And of course, in Ashtanga Yoga, there's Yam Niyam to start off the process of yoga, which means that before one takes to the practice of asana and meditation and fixing one's mind on the supersoul within the heart, Ishvara Pranidhan, one has to act properly within the world, because the way we act in the world will reflect on us, and also their reactions for everything that we do. The way we move in the world, the way we think, the way we speak has a profound effect on not only ourselves but also the others that we meet, and helps to create our environment. Hence this topic, Yoga of the Tongue. And all of you hopefully have an outline. If you don't, maybe there's somebody near you you can look on with. And I'm going to be starting with the outline that says Yoga of the Tongue at the top. And as we're just getting started, I would like to hear from you. Do we have the remote microphone? That's good. And who's the runner? Eugene's the runner? Okay. You have to get between each person, contributor within 2 seconds. Otherwise, you'll be fired. Okay, so think about ways in which things people have said to you in your life have affected you, both positively and negatively. And if you care to share them, there may be a statement that someone said when you were young, when you were in fourth grade, and someone said, oh, you're a good artist, or someone said, oh, you'll never amount to anything. You can't play basketball. Something like that, that stuck in your mind that affected you for a long time. Any statement, positive or negative. And if you like, you can share it. A pie breaks the ice.
In elementary school, I used to consistently get on my report cards, Anthony has tremendous potential.
Nice.
It was basically, what he was really saying was, who I was wasn't good enough. Hmm. And after some time, it kind of dawned on me it had a certain negative effect. That consistent, like, he could be something of value.
When did it dawn on you?
When I got older, later, as I started to assess all my multiple dysfunctions.
And you realized that had an effect on your overall...
Yes, I needed validation, is what I needed, and love, instead of being told that if I became something else, then that would be an object of love.
Okay, nice one. Very nice. I mean, they're all nice. Okay, thank you very much. Noah's got something for us.
When I was 19, I was doing different meditations and things, and one time I started getting this shamanism, and I came to my dad, and he was kind of into mystical stuff too, so, but he's a little calloused and jaded, and he's been through it all, so I said, I'm going to become a shaman. He said, you haven't suffered enough to become a shaman. So that made me feel like pretty much like I had no support in spiritual life, you know, in my, as far as my family went. You know, I was just like, well, you know, he doesn't want to encourage me to even try. He's just saying, you got to suffer more. So.
And did that stick with you for some time?
That was the first thing I thought of just now. So,
okay,
yeah.
So obviously it stuck somewhere. Yeah. Okay, yes, Mataji in the back.
When I was 14, I was learning how to play horn, and I couldn't get a tone. The teacher kept trying to tell me how to make this fork and everything, and I never could catch on. So one day he got exasperated and he said, "You play like a girl." And after that, I knew exactly what he meant. So I still remember that. When I play my horn, I don't want to play like a girl.
Okay. Anyone else?
This is when I was growing up in India. From my father, around that time when I was growing up, alcohol was coming in the small villages, and people, some of the people were drinking and whatnot. So one morning, my mother wanted me to drink milk, and I said, "No, I don't want to drink milk." And my father made one statement, and that's still in my head. He said, "He doesn't want to drink milk, he wants to drink something else." And I still remember that.
Okay, thank you very much. Last word, anyone want? One more? Okay, so if we dredge our memory, we'll find that there are statements that linger. Something someone said that was positive or negative. The point is that words have a profound effect. In the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Krishna says that they can be like sharp arrows. In fact, he says that a sharpened arrow can injure the body, but words which are piercing and which come from an envious heart can actually pierce the heart of another and injure severely that person for a long time. And words have great potency to injure or to encourage. So, one day, while I was walking in my neighborhood in Burlingame, California, which is about 20 miles from the San Francisco Bay, I noticed that all of the storm drains have this little emblem on them that says, "No dumping drains to bay." And I was considering how very far away one may be, that whatever you put into that storm drain eventually ends up in the bay. San Francisco Bay is becoming more polluted, like many bodies of water near cities. And then I began to consider how the storm drains resemble my ears. I mean, doesn't it kind of look like an ear there? Has an opening, right? And whatever goes in the ear drains into the bay of the heart. The heart of is the seat of emotions, according to the Yoga Sutra. It's the seat of consciousness. And this bay of the heart, when polluted with mundane sounds or demotivating sounds, will change the state of the heart. However, if we put in positive vibration, transcendental vibration, the heart will be clarified. This is mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in a famous verse which Lord Kapiladev spoke to his mother, where he said, "Satam prasangam mama virya sambido bhavanti hridkarna rasayana kata tach joshanadashu apavarga vartmani shradaratir paktir anukaramishchati." And that is that if you associate with satam, that is, truthful people, those are those who are dedicated to truth and who are sincerely endeavoring for the highest goal of life. You'll hear in that association sounds which enter into the ears and then into the heart, and they act like medicine. Some medicine you ingest orally, some you inject intravenously. But in spiritual life, the sound or the medicine goes into the ear and enters the heart. And the verse goes on to say, "Tach joshanat ashu apavarga vartmani." So apavarga means that one reverses the normal material course, which is represented by the Sanskrit letters pa, pa, ba, ba, and ma. And pa means that one must work very hard in this world. It's the law. In fact, before you're born, your parents are already saving for a college fund. Why? Because when you come out, they're going to tell you a secret, and that is, you better get ready because you got to work hard. Get an education. When we're born in the world, the Srimad Bhagavatam says, Devarshi bhutapna nirnam pitranam na kinkaro nayam nirnichara jan saravatmanaya sharanam sharanyam kutomukandam parihritakartam. And that is that we already owe a debt from our previous life. And we owe the devas, means those who control the air and the rain and the wind. Just like at home, when you turn on the light switch, what do you get? You got to work with me here. When you turn on the faucet, you get? When you turn on the gas, you get? Gas, heat. And then when you go to the mailbox, you get? A bill. So, nothing's free. We may think all these, everything we have in the world is coming for free, but actually, Shastra says, we're rini, which means we're debtors. The devas, or the controllers of the universal elements, are supplying us, and there's a bill to pay. And then there are the rishis who have passed down transcendental spiritual knowledge, and we also owe them. And then there are bhutatma, which means ordinary living entities, like cows, give milk to everybody. And no one ever thanks them, practically. They just consume the milk, kill the cow, and move on. There's a debt to pay for that. So this is pa, means because of my debt, my karmic debt, I have to work hard. And then pa means that I have to work so hard that foam comes from my mouth. Then ba means that ultimately everything ends in defeat. And pa means bhayam, or fear. While I'm working in this world, I'm fearful. And ma is the last syllable, which stands for mrityu, or death. So I lose everything at death. This is the the symbolic representation of the material world. Pa, 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 ma. However, when you put an a in front of it, akar reverses the meaning of the word pavarga. Apavarga means you're transcending the world of birth and death. You're going back to the spiritual world. And so by hearing transcendental sound, all this takes place. Taj joshanad ashu apavarga vartmani. Very quickly, it acts when you hear the transcendental sound. And then, shraddha ratir bhakti anukramishti. Step by step, one advances in the process of yoga. The stages are mentioned. Shraddha means one's conviction develops within the heart. Rati means one gets a positive attraction. And bhakti means love of God develops in the heart. How? Just by the hearing process. So there are two kinds of sound in this world. One is material sound, and the other is spiritual sound. And the process of yoga, as mentioned in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, is to be very careful about what kind of sound I allow to come into the storm drains of my ear. Because remember, no dumping drains to the bay. And words are like seeds. They have weighted meanings. Every word and every tonality through which the word is expressed has a certain weight in our life, in our minds, in our thoughts. And there is a progression. From words come thoughts. From thoughts come actions. From our actions we develop habit. Our habit develops our character. And our character develops our destination. So looking at the root cause of where I am now, sometimes people wonder, how did I get to where I am now? The answer is, through your words, thoughts, actions, habit, character, destination. There's a progression, and I'm responsible for it. It's not that something's being perpetrated. The material nature is neutral. According to Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, Nakartritvam Nakarmani Lokasya Sujati Prabhu, that the laws of karma are not something that is being enacted upon us, but we're interacting with karma because of our desire, and therefore there's some reaction and we become entangled. So the process of controlling the tongue, being careful what kind of sound vibration I'm making, what kinds of words I'm letting out into the atmosphere, has a profound effect on my destination and the destination of others. In fact, so profound that when the sound vibration of the world is contaminated, there's a strong case for the fact that there are epidemics of misuse of the environment, for instance. When the thoughts and mind are contaminated, then one's actions tend to be contaminated. For instance, one doesn't think twice about polluting the environment. And there's a way in which disease develops from this contaminated ether or sound vibration. Comments or reflections so far? Any one thing that you heard that you want me to expound on or that you'd like to expound on?
You were speaking about how we have to be, it's basically that teaching that we need to be careful about what association we take in and what actions we do, that we need to do noble acts and be around noble people in order to continue to become more elevated in our consciousness. And it just made me think about this article that I just read from the New York Times about these Orthodox Jews in Israel, who they're the ultra-Orthodox, so they're afraid of contamination with the material world. And they've been exempt from military service, but as a result of that, they've also been unemployable. They only learn Hebrew, which is the sacred language, and they won't bend on any of their rules and regulations. The idea is that this world is bad and we have to take every precaution necessary to take every moment we can to purify ourselves so that we can return to God. So I was just kind of thinking about that and comparing that to my early days in Krishna consciousness, that kind of full immersion period, and then the reentry. And in the New York Times article, they were talking about how this most latest generation is re-entering, they're needing to re-enter because Israel's no longer able to support through governmental charities all of these children who are coming of age. So they have to work and support their families, and they have to find a way to get jobs and work in the world in a way that makes money. So I'm thinking about it so much in terms of the parallel of the way that our movement has gone too. And I was wondering if you could speak about that a little bit. The pure reentry. Like the way that I've been taught is to, it's the Jewish term for it is dress British and Yiddish. So the idea is you externally may look like everybody else, but internally you're focused on God and doing everything you can to be dharmic. But there is a process of contamination that happens. It is harder. I just wanted to hear what you had to say about that.
In the Sri Upanishad, thank you. Very interesting comment. In the Sri Upanishad, there is a statement, vidyam cha vidyam chayas tad vedo bayam saha avidyayam ratum tirtva vidyayam ratum ashnute. Only one who can learn the process of nescience and transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. there's a way in which with my interaction with the material world and nescience, so to speak, as I'm cultivating Krishna consciousness, can actually fortify my own heart and development of Krishna consciousness. And regarding movements, Stephen Covey one gave an interesting paradigm about how first there's dependence, and then there's independence, and then there's interdependence. Each one of them is a progression. So in the beginning, someone might join a movement and be very dependent in a way that he or she is not considering the context of the movement and everything it means, maybe just by momentum at some point. And then sometimes people become independent because they have a need to take a look at it to see, am I doing this because of momentum or social expectation, or am I doing it because I'm actually making spiritual advancement and out of my free will? And then the strongest position is that when one's taken a look at both positions, he or she comes back out of his or her own volition and says, yes, this is what I'm going to embrace. And of course, as Goshti Anandis, which means our movement is based on an idea that we are interacting with society. In fact, following in the footsteps of Prahlad Maharaj, who said, I don't want to live in a cave or in the mountains alone, but I want to live in the busiest parts of the world so that I can interact with people and actually share with them the benefits of spiritual consciousness. And in that way, we must also practice fortifying ourselves. So, as we say, my friend Matthew, who was a paramedic for 20 years, said that a dead paramedic, they teach you the first thing in paramedic school is a dead paramedic can't save anybody. So they say, save yourself first. When you come to a disaster scene, make sure that you don't get killed trying to save people. And so we have to fortify ourselves first. But complete isolation doesn't necessarily help us to grow. In fact, in botany, there's an experiment I read about where plants, when isolated to their own species, are very docile. But when they're mixed with other kinds of species, they sense that there's competition and they grow very strong. And so as we mix as Goshti Anandis with society, we fortify ourselves, we understand what our values are, but we do mix with the greater society. Rather than syncretizing everything that we come in contact with, we actually clarify more what our position is in contraposition to what we see. And we can become stronger. Is that an okay answer?
Excellent.
Okay, thank you. Any other points on what we've talked about so far? Then let's move on. You are what you speak. And this is an interesting point. We can judge this very easily by measuring our speech. And it's a question that Arjuna asked to Krishna in the dialogue, which constitutes the Bhagavad Gita. And he asks, what is the symptom of someone who's fixed in consciousness? Stita prajnasika bhasha. And this is a question. Bhasha means your speech. So stita prajnasa, stita means to be situated in something, and prajnasa means to be in full consciousness. There are many stages of consciousness mentioned in the Shastra, and Arjuna wants to know, what is the symptom of somebody who's actually fixed in consciousness? Is there a verifiable symptom? I mean, this is an interesting topic also about what is verifiable about somebody's state of consciousness. And according to the commentary Prabhupada gives on this verse in the Bhagavad Gita, the most verifiable symptom of somebody's state of consciousness is their bhasha, their speech. And Jiva Goswami writes that KK exactly equals your KC. Here's a formula you can take with you. KK equals KC. KK means Krishna Katha. Everyone say Krishna Katha. This means one's propensity to speak about God. And KC means Krishna consciousness, the level of your Krishna consciousness. Because in the Krishna, in the realm of Krishna consciousness, we consider Krishna consciousness, or being conscious of the personality of Godhead out of the many different features of God, to be the highest state of consciousness. So Jiva Goswami, one of the great scholars of our line, had made this point that you can measure for yourself, what are you speaking? If you're speaking Krishna Katha, to that degree, you're Krishna conscious. He also said that your eagerness to hear about Krishna, your eagerness to hear Krishna Katha, also directly equals your level of Krishna consciousness. So now measure for yourself. How eager are you to hear about Krishna? My friend Bhurijan Prabhu, who has written several books and was working in Vrindavan, in one of the ashrams there, was a popular person because he studies a lot. People like to ask him things, but he needed time alone to write, and he didn't want to be rude to people. And so sometimes people would stop by to talk to him, and he said he found often that the quickest way to clear the room was to pull out a Chaitanya Charitamrita and said, let's read a little bit. And then he goes, I have to go now, because their desire to hear wasn't so strong. And Shraddha. We spoke yesterday about saffron mercy particles. It was a verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is kind of a postgraduate study of the Bhagavad Gita. And this word also is very important in the realm of Krishna consciousness, Shraddha. So Shradd means the heart. And Da, second part of the word, is an active verb, and it means where you place something. So Shraddha, could everyone please say Shraddha? Shraddha means where you place your heart. You may have an idea, but and someone might tell you to do something and say, my heart wasn't in it. You ever say that? Or ever hear that? My heart just wasn't in it. And in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Ramananda Roy points out that the body is like a chariot and the heart is the driver. Whatever your heart dictates, you go there. In fact, we vote with our feet. We exhibit what's actually in our heart by where we show up. You may say that I believe in this or that, but did you actually show up for it? If not, we can count your vote otherwise. So Shraddha is very important. And the level of Shraddha that one has within one's heart is expressed through the sound vibration that one makes. Regarding you are what you speak and stita prajnasika basha, Srila Prabhupada mentions that a well-dressed fool, it's an old aphorism, that a well-dressed fool is not discovered until he or she speaks. He had nothing to say, and then he said it. So this is the indicator of what one's level of consciousness is, and also a measure of what's in one's heart. The faith that's in one's heart, it comes out through the words, the Shraddha. And yesterday we heard in poetical terms that when a person whose heart is clarified, is pure, has no motive, in other words, is interested in the welfare of others, which is a natural result of cleaning the heart. And the terminology we heard yesterday was nindari shunya, hridam ipsita, sangalabhya. In Sanskrit it means that a person who's taken the trouble to clean their heart is no longer interested in criticizing others. Ninda, the tendency to drag others down, is called envy. That is, the inability to tolerate the eminence of another is pervasive within the world. This is called envy. It resides within the heart of all living beings, according to Krishna. But through the process of purification, that tendency diminishes. And when somebody's heart is purified and they don't have envy in their heart, when they speak, it's for the benefit of others. This is called mukya prasada. That means whatever they say is beneficial, because the heart full of goodwill for others, the Mahatma, whose heart is as big as the sky and is interested in the welfare of others, when he or she speaks, the vibration has a powerful effect. And we heard yesterday, as I was saying poetically, that the vibration of a pure devotee's speech touches the lotus feet of Krishna and dislodges saffron particles, saffron mercy particles. And the speech is mixed with those saffron mercy particles. So the Shastra says, no wonder when it enters the ear and in the heart, it has a purifying effect. And one can feel the difference when one speaks, when one hears from a person whose heart is clarified and freed from envy. Interesting, here are the saffron mercy particles for your edification. In Palo Alto, California, there's a company called HeartMath. Have you ever heard of that? And they've done extensive research, especially on the heart, scientific research, to see what kinds of effects the heart has on the brain and on other people. And according to their research, which is available on their website, there are measurable effects, even non-verbally, from people's hearts, what they're emanating from their heart. In other words, there's a pulse, there's an energy that actually comes from the heart that affects our nervous system, our brain, and so forth, and measurably people around us as well. So the kind of vibration that we keep there affects others. And that brings us to the topic of mantra. Man means mind, and tra comes from the word trayate, which means to deliver. The mind is endlessly caught in either the future or the past, and very rarely is able to live in the moment. And there are many stories that come through the mind, and it's easy to hook onto those stories and become caught in sort of a whirlpool. The mantra frees us from that. And according to the dictionary, a mantra is a sound, syllable, word, or group of words that is considered capable of creating transformation. Please repeat after me. A mantra is a sound, syllable, word, or group of words that is considered capable of creating transformation. So this is a very important part of yoga of the tongue, mantra, because mantra is generated by the tongue. The tongue has muscles in it, and it works in a certain way. And here's a Vedic statement. This is from the Vedanta Sutra, Shastra Yoni Dvat, which means that the yoni means the womb. So the Shastra Yoni Dvat means that the realization of God and higher consciousness comes from the Shastra. And you'll see underneath here, this is actually some very ancient writings on palm leaves written by hand. The Shastra previously was written on palm leaves using a stylus, where you'd make an impression and then it would be placed in the sun, and then there would be a difference in the color. They actually last for hundreds of years, and many Shastras, of course, originally they were passed down by word of mouth from one teacher to disciple. One would live in a gurukula, which meant a pure environment so that one would have such an open mind and heart and no other distractions, so that when you'd hear the Vedic sounds, you hear these mantras, they would stick and stay very deep within the heart. However, later on, because so many distractions in this age, Now we have them written down because memories are very short in this day and age. So this is one of the statements that the root cause of our advancement in spiritual life comes from the Shastra. And another statement from Shastra's Tarko Pratishtanat, which means that just by intellectual argument, one never comes to a proper conclusion. In other words, there's always a contrary opinion when you simply argue intellectually. Do you like it? I thought it was hilarious. Pratishtanat means a place to stand, and tarko means argument. Through argument, you don't have any standing in this world. There's always someone who will come upset your argument. Doesn't matter how great of an arguer you are and how well you put forward your particular argument, someone will come either now or 2,000 years from now and overturn your argument. Therefore, tarko pratishtanat. There's no standing in argument. Therefore, Shastra Yonidvat. You have to take Shastra. Shastra is considered, that is scripture, it's considered to be eternal and transcendental. It's apurusheya. It's not created by human beings. And one has to believe this, actually, at least to begin with. And then by taking the Shastra, by hearing the sound vibration from the Shastra, one will have one's own experience. But by being a tarki, don't be a tarki, simply arguing about the nature of the Absolute, one will never come to the proper conclusion. And another aphorism, mantra, which is that the root of all realization comes from Shastra. And then very importantly, anavritti shabdat, which means we can become liberated by sound. The mantra can actually liberate us, take us out of the material world altogether just by the sound vibration, by the mantra, anavritti shabdat. And we can come to realize the supreme within the heart. And Narada Muni in the Srimad Bhagavatam mentions that the mantra itself, mantra murtima murtikam, he says, with the mantra is the way to realize the complete form of God. And he says that there's a way in which murti means form, and it also means difficulty. So he says, mantra murtim amurtikam, that by the mantra, one can very easily realize the form of God. And then we have sampradaya, which means the mantras are passed down from one spiritual teacher to another, and the word sampradaya means the complete gift. Sam means complete, and pradaya means a gift that's passed down to us. So the mantras are imparted from one self-realized person to a disciple, and then they germinate within the heart of the disciple who realizes them and passes them along, and the mantras come down to us in a form that we can utilize and actually become liberated from the material world altogether. Now we'll take some comments and reflections so far. Yes, Tushta. Go ahead and start and I'll repeat what you're saying.
We know that argument, there's no standing, we just argue. But what about a sincere expression of doubt and question? Because for some...
Sound vibration is very powerful.
For some disbelief and fault, some may have a certain simplicity where they can just follow and believe. But for one who still has sincerity, but yet has an outcome of questioning and doubt,
yeah, regarding a doubt and questioning, this is not in the realm of being a tarki. However, the Srimad Bhagavatam says that one of the functions of the intelligence is to doubt. And that this is important because one has to test various theories and whatever somebody presents to you. If you don't have a doubting intelligence, then how can you test it and find out for yourself? However, once one finds the proper source, once one discerns that there is a proper source for taking knowledge, then one should specialize and suspend one's disbelief. Otherwise, you get infinite regress and you can't make progress. You have to accept at some point axiomatic truth in order to advance in any science. In mathematics, there are axiomatic truths. Everyone just accepts them. In any scientific endeavor, there are axiomatic truths. And when you go to college, you'll accept them. Otherwise, you'll be bounced out of the class. You won't be accepted. And in the Vedic process also, there are axiomatic truths. And you can test them and then come to the point of accepting the source. And then Tadvidi pranipatena priprashnena sevaya upadakshanti te jnanam jnaninas tatvadarshina. One should approach in humility, with an openness to take in and suspend disbelief at that point. At that point, when one finds the proper source, if one remains in a challenging mood, then one won't be benefited. Example of the infinite regress is given that if you, for instance, you say, prove that water boils at, 200 degrees? So I say it boils at 200 degrees Fahrenheit. And you say, prove it. So I put a thermometer in the water and I turn it on, and at 200 degrees, the water starts to boil. And you say, prove that's a real thermometer. And then I get a thermometer testing kit and I prove it. It's a thermometer. And then you say, prove that's a real thermometer testing kit. And on it goes. This is what's called infinite regress. And there's a point at which, according to Socrates, who's talking about this infinite regress, that just like a retreating army, at one point it actually has to turn around and make a positive stand on a certain point. You have to accept a certain source for taking in knowledge. Everyone does. And in transcendental knowledge, it's the same as well. So when you've exercised your doubting capacity and you've come to the point of understanding that there is a source for real knowledge and you accept it, then as axiomatic, then you can make progress. And it's not that it's blind faith. It's that you have to stay at a certain point to test it. You have to have a certain ability to accept it and test it on yourself. As Prabhupada says in the beginning of his Bhagavad Gita, that whether you believe Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead or not, for the sake of reading this book, just for now, accept it and take it in that spirit, and then you'll be able to actually imbibe the real process that Krishna is giving in the Gita. Okay? Any other points? So the tongue is like a rudder. And I just happen to have a Bible with me. I'm a Bible thumper from way back. Actually, that's not true. I've never read the Bible very carefully, but I did. When I had included this in the presentation about how the tongue, notice how the tongue is a small organ and small part of our bodies, but it directs how we move in life. And then someone brought to my attention, I think it was one of the devotees at the Dharma Den the other night, the one I was teaching the Madanga to. What's his name? Alex. He said that, your tongue is your rudder. It directs how you move in your life. And he said, that's in the Bible. He had just been discussing it with somebody. I said, where is it in the Bible? And then my wife Googled it and found it. So here it is, if I may. Taming the tongue. Not many of you presume to be teachers. Not many of you should presume to be teachers. This is from James in the New Testament. because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Although they are so large, they are driven by strong winds. They are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set afire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person, sets the whole course of his life on fire, and itself is set on fire by hell. So I just thought it was interesting that there are these analogies about the tongue and how a ship, even though it's being accosted by great winds, can stay afloat and go in the right direction when it has a rudder. Without the rudder, the boat is all over the place. My father taught me how to sail when I was a kid, and we had a small boat. But I remember asking him, what do we need this for? It was a rudder. in an El Toro, which is a small boat, it goes through the center of the hull down into the water. And I was asking, what do we need that for? And he said, we'll tip over if we don't have it, and we can't go in a straight line with the sail. And it was just such a small thing. And the tongue is like that also. How we control the tongue, according to the Shastra, will determine our outcome in our practice of yoga. And the famous verse, Atashri Krishna Namadi, Nabaved Grayam Indriye, Sevan Mukihi Jivado, Swayam Eva Spuratyada. Amazingly, this verse says, from the Padma Purana, that yoga begins with the tongue. And first of all, the statement is that we can't realize God by the blunt material senses. It's impossible for the infinitesimal to realize the infinite. But if he reveals himself to us, then we can understand. And then it says, how is it that one can attract the infinite? By controlling the tongue. In seva, seva means service. If you engage the tongue in service, then the infinite will be attracted to and will reveal himself to you. This is what the verse says. So in that sense, everything in yoga begins with the tongue. And if you just do this one thing, you control your speech. You're careful about how you speak. This is vachovegam. And jihovegam means controlling the tongue and controlling the speech. Frogs croak unrestrictedly, and what happens? It attracts the snakes. They come and they eat the frog. So similarly, unrestricted speech, it attracts death, according to the Shastra. So being careful how we control our speech is a beginning point to the yoga process, and all success can be there. What else does the tongue do besides speak? Definitely tastes and eats. The tongue is accustomed to tasting many, many things. And this is the second aspect mentioned in Shastra, that if you're careful about your diet and you eat food that is transcendental, that is, it's first offered for sacrifice, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, jagna shishta shina shanto, that before you eat food, if you offer it to God, it becomes transcendental, spiritual. And then when you eat, all your senses become purified by taking prasadam. Prasade sarvadukhanam hanirasyo pajayate prasana chetaso yashu bhuti pariyavatishtate. And that is, by taking prasad, that means spiritual food, all one's misery goes away. One's intelligence becomes fortified. And one becomes happy by that. So the tongue is very important in that aspect. And one's speech should be impeccable. Impeccable is a word that comes from Latin, means which is impeccare, which means without sin. So the tongue, when trained to speak in certain ways, will become impeccable, and that will have an entire effect on our life, and it will direct our outcome and our advancement in yoga. That's my proposition. And I'm backing it up with Shastra. Point so far. Yes, Abhay.
I'm just curious, I mean, all the time that I've known you, your speech has always been impeccable. So I'm wondering how this... You
know, is it?
Yes. I'm wondering how you felt compelled or inspired to address this.
Well, one thing I learned about speech, I learned a lot by going out into public and meeting with people over and over again. I've been going out to meet people on the streets and airports and here and there, everywhere, to one-on-one for about 40 years now. And because of doing that and getting immediate feedback from my interlocutors, the people I'm speaking to, I've found that a little bit of speech which is ill-motivated, a tiny bit of ill-motivated speech gives a disproportionate, unfavorable result. I've had that experience enough times to develop an intense desire to reform my speech. That's why when I gave the presentation last night, I kept emphasizing that when we meet people, we should, our prime directive is to leave them with a good impression. That we should always be endeavoring to do that. And later on in this presentation, I present how Krishna talks about the austerities of speech. And he says, one should speak truthfully, beneficially, avoiding speech that offends, and one should also recite the Vedas regularly. And so, I guess by practice and trial and error and hearing, I'm not agreeing with your premise at all, but I am saying that I have had some experience that a few words uttered at the wrong time for the wrong reason, it can come back in such a profound way. And also, I've realized in the positive sense as well. One time when I was in Honolulu, I was distributing Srimad Bhagavatams on Kalakaua Avenue, which is a really funny place to distribute Srimad Bhagavatam. Because Hawaii is a rented island. Everyone goes there as a rent-a island just to forget who they are for a while and have all kinds of crazy fun. And they're not that interested in spiritual life normally, especially walking up and down Kalakaua Avenue. In any case, one evening I was there, dressed in devotional garb, along with my friend Satyadev Prabhu, and we had been chanting a lot at the temple, and we were feeling happy, and we were there distributing books together, and the breezes were blowing, the smell of jasmine was in the air, and I approached a newlywed couple, and I showed them a Bhagavatam, and it just told them a little bit about it. It told them that it was for a donation. We didn't have to have the money, but if they gave something in return, it was kind of a tradition that would help them enter into the book in a deeper way and so forth. And they rejected it. They said, we're Christians. We don't believe in this, and we don't believe in your cause, and please take it back, and that's it. But because I was feeling transcendental because of my association and because of being at the temple and so forth. I felt only goodwill towards them, and I had said I appreciated very much that they had taken their valuable time. And I said that to them, and I said, it was just an honor to meet you. And I had honestly no expectation, and I didn't feel at all put off by the reversal that they weren't interested and they sort of flat out rejected it. And I expressed that to them, and they walked away. And about a half an hour later, I was talking to somebody else, and I saw them in my peripheral vision. that original couple. And they walked up to me and they said, "We changed our minds. We'd like to give a donation." And then, and anyway, I had some more conversation with them. But because I had, because of the way I had spoken to them, it had affected them. And they changed their mind. They changed their heart. The words had had that impression upon them. And I realized that everyone we talk to, they may go away. We may not see them again. But what we say has an effect on people. And as I mentioned earlier, the beginning of Ashtanga Yoga, Yam and Niyam. Yam means you have to learn to speak properly. You have to learn to interact with people without disturbing their minds and so forth. Otherwise, it comes back to you constantly, and you'll be distracted. You won't be able to move forward in your yoga practice. So the tongue is the main culprit in doing either. That is, doing good or sabotaging your relationships in the world. Tulsi Balava Prabhu. Is this okay so far?
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't sure if I'm using too much Sanskrit or any of that. Okay.
In general communication or speaking, there's, you know, you said most of the person, which affects also is non-verbal communication, like our behavior and expressions. I was wondering if you could share 10 facts on religion.
Well, non-verbal communication, yeah, it's very important. You can notice this if you ever have interactions over the internet. And somebody sends you an email, and then you misunderstand it, and then when you meet them, they say, "No, I didn't mean that at all." And also, I've heard the other day that more important than the words you speak is the tone that you speak it in. The tone is much more important. If you have a spouse, somebody you live with constantly, you know, they can pick up on your tone very easily. "I don't like that tone." "What? I said the right thing. I didn't like the tone." What is the tone? You know, we all have a tone, and it comes out of our shraddha. It comes out of what we have in our heart. If we have a purified heart, our tone is different. That's what saffron mercy particles means. The tone of a pure devotee, or someone who's truthful, they're actually sincerely trying to be truthful, then their tone is different. It comes out in a different way. We met a guy last night. I mean, we met so many nice people on the street last night who were so interested in Bhagavad Gita and really liked that we were out there and thought it was a great thing. We went out chanting on the street, and also we were giving out prasadam, cookies, and we were distributing books. And Tulsi Balava Prabhu and I were working together. We met about maybe 10 people in a row that were just totally into the Bhagavad Gita and bought the copy and walked off happy. And near the end of the night, there was a man standing there who wanted to have some kind of an altercation, verbally anyway. And he sort of waded his way through the devotees, and he said, he was looking at me and he goes, "Is that the leader guy over there? You know, I want to talk to him." And then when he started talking to me, I just have an experience of talking to people, and his demeanor, the way he was, he began the whole speech, asking me a whole volley of questions that weren't, that indicated he wasn't really interested in the answer so much, but he just wanted to have an altercation. And so he was asking me questions, and I was resisting. And he was saying, "What are you doing out here? Why are you doing this?" And, you know, sort of demanding answers and so forth. And I was like, "Why do you ask? And isn't it obvious what we're doing?" Things like that. And he said, "Well, why are you challenging me back?" And I said, "It seems that you're insincere about, you know, what you're asking." So how can you tell? And I said, "Well, first of all, your body language," the way he was standing, goes, "Oh, okay, sorry." it's profound how when we communicate with another conscious living entity, what's actually going on there. There's another conscious sentient being. Sentient means sensitive. How is it that we're sensitive? That's interesting in and of itself. And then how we express ourselves. I mean, the sound comes out through a voice box, and it vibrates according to, you know, an impulse that we have that comes from the heart into the mind, and then it comes out into the ether. And it's different according to one's motivation and one's heart, and the tonality is different according to what one's intention is in speaking. And this is much the essence of our spiritual practice. Shastra Yoni Dvat, what is coming out of the sound vibration, affects us deeply. And so our speech must be impeccable, and we have to be careful about what kind of vibration we make to ourselves also. What we're saying to ourselves also has an effect, and what we say to others. Other points? Yes. 1001 and a half. Okay.
What's been your realizations throughout the years in regards to this principle of familiarity breeds contempt? So whether it's amongst brothers or sisters or parents and children or spouses or friends or associates in our activities of work or social life, it seems that if you're just traveling from place to place and you meet someone for a few moments, you can get away with looking like a person of good character. But then in our familiar dealings, it seems like it's a real challenge. So what's been your realizations as far as in those familiar situations, this whole process of speech control in our interactions, and then when is there allowance for sometimes maybe the tone when maybe there requires some, there may be some intensity there, not out of envy. But anyways, just overall your realization.
A lot of points there and good ones. One thing I just want to give a disclaimer. I'm not saying that with a purified heart one is simply always placid and one's speech is placid and one is neutral in everything one says. Not necessarily the case. There may be in which somebody with a purified heart may become passionate in one's speech and even critical. But because the intention is correct and aligned properly, there will be a benefit from it. This is what Mukhya Prasadad means. It doesn't mean that, everything's okay, and I simply neutralize everything. My experience is that familiarity, if one is dedicated to a relationship, the point is that even when one sees, or especially when one sees the foibles in another, or allows others to see one's own foibles, that one's able to deepen the relationship. But it's very rare, because most people guard the ego sort of wants to guard us. It's not really, it wants to guard us, and so I can present myself in a certain way. Say, this is who I am. I don't want anybody to know any of my deficiencies. However, in a very deep relationship, there's a way in which one can expose one's deficiencies. And it gives the... then you have an opportunity to see, you know, was it superficial or not? Because generally, what I find generally is when somebody becomes vulnerable and they actually expose who they really are, people really take an interest because it's so rare. Like in public speaking, if someone comes out and says, now I'm going to tell you about, you know, who I really am. Everyone's like, wait a minute now, let's hear this. Let me tell you about the time I really blew it. And, everyone wakes up suddenly. If it's just philosophy, everyone's like, yeah, it's all right, but... when you tell about yourself and where you're really at, everyone wakes up and takes, you know, front seat to find out what's going on. And to be able to have a relationship where you can actually expose that is a good thing. And this is what's mentioned in the Nectar of Instruction, Kuya Makyati Prichati. Kuya means what's secret, actually. I mean, everyone knows all the external stuff and how you're trying to present yourself. That's pretty obvious. But when you actually come out and say what's in your heart and expose that, then it becomes deep. And in an organization or in a family like you have here, a spiritual family, if there's time, if you take one-on-one time to talk to people and get to know them, it's really important. And if there's time for devotees to be together and talk about what's in their hearts and what's going on, within certain parameters, because there are people who can also sabotage the whole process too, and sort of dominate the whole thing with a certain kind of agenda. So that you also have to protect against that as well. Anyway, that's just the beginning to the answer. We can say more about it later, but we're sort of running over. Yes.
So what you're talking about, to me, sounds like real intimacy, revealing one's heart to others. And seems to me that a lot of the problems that we've had in our movement, it came from not having so much of that culture of allowing ourselves to be imperfect and to share ourselves with each other as we actually are. And I guess what I've been working on lately is, you know, learning how to... I come more from, like, the Esalen world, where you just are really direct with each other, and it's kind of raw, but people are committed to truth. And for the last 17 years, I've been trying to work with this different energy of ISKCON, and I'm finally coming to a place of finding a balance where I'm learning how to share with people in a way that's pleasing, honoring their tenderness or fear of not being seen as perfect, kind of honoring the male ego or the female ego, not irritating that too much, because that's important in order to be able to have an impact. And then taking the time, hopefully, to develop our relationship so that we can really get to a place of some actual substance. Because I know in my life, just doing stuff isn't satisfying. It's that connection interpersonally that was my primary connection to Krishna, to, you know, sadhana and chanting, and then that interpersonal was just incredibly important. So I feel like as I grow, I can also see that the movement is also maturing. You know, the two sides are kind of coming together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's a nice point. And there's no replacement for maturity in any movement or within a family or within one's own heart. And maturity comes, it's hard-won territory to actually become mature. Because often those who are mature, they're like, you know, sea captains who have been across the ocean a bunch of times and have maybe sunk twice, and they know what it's like to actually recover the ship and, you know, be saved and things like that. So I'll just make this last point because we're over time. And it relates to what the point you made, Tushta, and what you were just saying. Tell me your name again.
Ananda.
Thank you. Sorry. And that is, it can be helpful to have tools to use in communication. Just like there's this science of non-violent communication. And I've seen it many times in counseling couples, for instance, who are trying to have a deeper relationship, but they don't have the tools to talk to one another. And if they get a couple tools and they learn how to speak in such a way that they don't injure the other person's sensitivities, and they employ those, then they're much more likely to succeed. I've seen that. So in familiarity breeds contempt. There's parameters of communication that really help so that we can be familiar and at the same time, as Ananda was bringing out, not go too far to really disturb the person's mind or their sensitivities. Now, there's more to say about this tomorrow, and there's some practical matters that are on the outline, sort of philosophical things that have to do with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Shikshashtakam, which have to do with liberation by sound. And then the practices are tomorrow. there are actual practical applications of the principle of austerity of speech and pleasing speech, beneficial speech, not agitating to others, regularly reciting the Vedas and those kinds of things. And tomorrow as well, I have a presentation that relates to that about the process of chanting Hare Krishna, the Maha Mantra as a regular practice, and how that perfects the tongue and how the vibration changes our heart and so forth. Thank you very much, and all glories to the assembled devotees. Yes, Nirkula. Oh, actually, could you just hand the outlines in and then tomorrow you can take them? What? You took notes on your outline? You're in big trouble. No, I'm just kidding. All right, well, can you bring them back tomorrow? Bring back everything tomorrow. If you're not intending to bring them back tomorrow, please give them to Laura. If you think there's a chance you won't bring them back, then give them to Laura. We don't want to waste them. Yes? Breakfast downstairs. For everyone who's attended the conference today, just go down the stairs and please join us for breakfast. Thank you very much for coming. Hare Krishna. Vancha kopa durubhascha kripa sundabhi vacha patitanam pavanibhyo vaishnavibhyo namo namaha.